This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Emily Keel. I'll be facilitating the daily Department of Health media briefing. With me today is Dr. Josh Clayton and Secretary of Health Kim Mulsom-Risden, and we'll get started with the new case update here with Dr. Clayton.
All right. Good morning. Today we're reporting 60 new cases of COVID-19 in the state. This does include 9 new hospitalizations as well as 4 new deaths. Those 4 deaths occurred among Minnehaha County residents. We have 70 new individuals who have recovered from COVID-19 as well as 569 new negative tests that have been performed. In total, that brings our COVID-19 case count to 3,792. This does include 1,312 active infections and 2,437 individuals who have recovered. We have 290 total hospitalizations, 43 total deaths, and 22,681 total negative tests that have been performed. 4 cases by county. We have 11 in Brown, 1 in Charles Mix, 1 in Clark, 1 in Davison, 1 in Grant, 2 in Lincoln, 1 in Lyman, 33 in Minnehaha, 4 in Pennington, 3 in Roberts, 1 in Union, and 1 in Yankton. For new cases by age range, we have 5 in the 0 to 19 year age category, 12 in the 20 to 29 year age category, 14 in the 30 to 39 year age category, 9 in the 40 to 49 year age category, 10 in the 50 to 59 year age category, 8 in the 60 to 69 year age category, and 2 in the 80 and older category. For new cases by sex, we have 29 that are male and 31 that are female. For the deaths by county, we have 2 in Beadle, 1 in Girald, 1 in McCook, 38 in Minnehaha, and 1 in Pennington. For deaths by age range, we have 1 in the 30 to 39 year age category, 1 in the 40 to 49 year age category, 6 in the 50 to 59 year age category, 7 in the 60 to 69 year age category, 5 in the 70 to 79 year age category, and 23 in the 80 and older category. For deaths by sex, we have 21 that are male and 22 that are female.
And with that, we'll open it up for any questions.
Good morning, JP, RN News Radio.
Go ahead, JP.
Thank you very much. Of the patients recovered, would the health department know how many of those suffered permanent lung damage as a result of, let's say, scarring from the COVID-19 virus?
So there are an increasing list of sequelae due to COVID-19. That is not something that is actively tracked at a level that the public health department focuses on. That is an individual concern, and the focus there is on medical management of any potential long-term consequences. We do have a focus on trying to collect all pertinent information, and we know that we're seeing, again, increasing issues related to individuals who have tested positive with COVID-19 and are trying to capture all relevant information, but that is not something that we currently capture with our case information.
Next
Thank
question.
You.
Jackie with SDPB.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Thanks. I'm wondering if you can tell us about plans for mass testing in long-term care facilities.
Hi, this is Kim Mulsom-Risden. Governor Noem will talk about this later today in her press conference.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, next question.
Yes, it's Beth Warden with Dakota News Now.
Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Yes, of the 43 deaths, how many have taken place at a private residence outside of a hospital?
That is not information that I have readily available. Please go ahead and submit your request to our information or communications staff.
Beth, go ahead and email me today at covidmedia@state.sd.us, and I'll follow up with you.
Thank you.
Yep. Next question.
Gordon Richard, Alcester Union, Hudson Heights.
Hi, Gordon. Go ahead.
Dr. Clayton, 3,800 cases in South Dakota. That's not really correct, is it? I mean, it's twice that many that are really out there, maybe three times. Can you comment on that? And then, are there more counties that are having cases? Is there a spike out there?
So what I would say around the cases is that we are doing symptom-based testing to help identify cases, and we do know that there are individuals who develop COVID-19 illness but do not have symptoms, and so there is a level of infection kind of out in the general community that is not reflected in our case numbers. That is both just as kind of a general knowledge piece, as well as a reflection of individuals who may not seek testing due to mild symptoms. The second question around counties is that, yes, we are seeing additional cases in some counties where we have not had cases in a while. It's not due to any specific event that we've identified through our investigation. So I think the focus here is that individuals need to take proper precautions at the individual level, make sure that they're making good choices, washing their hands frequently. If they're out in public, one of the precautionary steps is that they can wear a cloth face mask or cloth face covering. So just those common sense precautions that we have been that we know work and that we have as proven precautions to avoid illness.
Next question, please.
This is Lisa with the Argus Leader.
Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, just wondering if you have the total number of cases and recovered cases connected to Demcota. And also just wondering, we're hearing about two different retail businesses in Brown County where there have been positives, and just wondering if there's any concern for the public related to those.
So the number of Demcota cases as of today is 95. This does include 45 individuals who have recovered. As far as the two retail businesses, we are constantly, through our investigations, identifying whether individuals in specific settings pose a risk to the general public. And those are, again, focused on individuals that have had 5 minutes or more of close contact, defined as within 6 feet of an individual. And that that individual has not been, wearing any protective equipment, such as a mask, and that the individual case was not able to specifically identify those individuals that they were around. So it's common that individuals in a business that we don't do a public notice because there's no exposure to the general public, and do that public notice. It's with that recognition that there's a risk that's posed to the public, that information is relayed via our press releases.
Okay.
Thank you. Next question.
Adam St. Paul, Dakota Broadcasting.
Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
And I just to follow up on that, because I kind of asked this question yesterday and they gave a similar answer. Just so I understand it, you're not necessarily saying that there isn't exposure at these places, but any employee at a public place, if as long as they don't have the opportunity to be around people who they could infect, you don't disclose it, I guess?
Yeah, so in an individual business, if all of the work close contacts can be identified, that is not cause for a public notice. It's only when a person would have direct contact with the public at large through the course of their work while they were either asymptomatic or in the 2 days prior to becoming symptomatic, where the individual is able to transmit the virus. So we do look, and we do know that we have individuals, you know, in different business settings, and we do focus on, you know, whether they were able to potentially transmit the virus, and whether there's anybody who, you know, is not easily identifiable within that business setting. So you are correct that we are doing that public notice when it extends beyond the business and there's a risk to the public.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. Next question.
This is Morgan at Rapid City Journal.
Go ahead, Morgan.
Can you talk really specifically about how the contact tracing works, like how you reach out to people, how many people are staffed to do this, and whether you'd like be going to a business and conducting interviews? Can you be really specific how that works?
Yeah. So the focus here is really around establishing a good relationship with the case. So we have our investigative staff that are used to working with individuals who have developed a reportable condition. Those staff are contacting the case that has tested positive. They collect from that individual those who have been in close contact with them, and that includes within the work setting, within the home setting, and within the community setting. And that those individuals, once they're identified by the case that has tested positive, our Department of Health staff contact those individuals to notify them of their potential exposure, and that we ask that they stay at home under self-quarantine for 14 days after their last exposure to that positive COVID-19 case. This is kind of part of our routine, you know, process for many other infectious diseases. The difference is that, you know, we're dealing with, 10-day isolation and 14-day quarantine having individuals self-monitor for illness. But you're correct that, you know, we're actively doing that follow-up on a daily basis, and we have over 100 individuals, around 131 individuals that are identified specifically for those investigations.
Morgan, this is Kim. The other thing I would mention is that we investigate every case within a 24-hour period from getting the lab result. And so timeliness is very important in that regard, and then the contact tracing immediately begins so people know to take the proper precautions. And that would include interviews with employers, depending on the case, you know, specifics of, you know, kind of where they were when they could have been transmitting the virus.
Yeah, that is one piece of your question that I didn't directly address, so I'll go ahead and do that now, which is that we do work with employers because we are asking that individuals, if whether they're cases or whether they're close contacts, that they stay at home during their isolation or quarantine period. And so we do conduct notifications to the employer, especially when that individual is a case that has a COVID-19 case, because that employer is also helpful in identifying others within the work setting and helping identify whether there is any potential risk to the public when it comes to potential for transmission of COVID-19.
Thank you.
Next question.
This is Joseph Barkoff with the Capital Journal.
Go ahead.
Good morning, y'all. Two questions. One's an easy one, and that's can you do an update on close contacts and employees from Smithfield, please? And then the second one is, Dr. Clayton, I'm going to take a stab and guess that you probably, as an epidemiologist, studied the 1918 pandemic. What are the biggest takeaways from studying that could be applied to this one, maybe that aren't being applied, or, you know, anything like that? Thank you.
So to answer the first question on those close contacts, we now have 830 Smithfield cases that have resolved their infection, as well as all 245 close contacts that have resolved their infection. The information around takeaways from the 1918 pandemic is that, you know, there are, with that, which 1918 pandemic was due to an influenza virus. So there are similarities, but there will obviously be differences from the pandemic that is playing out for us. One of the important things is a focus on, you know, potential for multiple waves. There was a wave in the spring of 1918, in the fall of 1918, and in the winter of 1918 that also went into early 1919. So the that is one piece I think that we need to remember, is that there is the potential for multiple waves or for continuing transmission over time. The second, I think, is just that focus on you know, individual precautions, business precautions, larger community precautions to help avoid the transmission of COVID-19. You know, we have been able to study as a retrospective picture of, you know, what went well and what did not go well with the 1918 pandemic, and that really has been a focus for our pandemic planning since 2005, as well as for this COVID-19 response. So, you know, there has been a lot of focus within the public health community as to how, you know, we should be responding. And the differences between influenza and COVID-19 are, you know, very apparent. And it being a different virus, the level of transmission even being different. But what one thing that does remain the same is they are both respiratory viruses, and it's very important that we take proper precautions with a focus on that route of transmission.
And we'll take one last question.
Gordon Richard, Alcester Union.
Okay, go ahead.
Our county has number four in the state, so that's why I have maybe more than one question. The whole idea of hospitalization rates, has that been spiking? And that's probably one of the most important statistics in the COVID South Dakota 19 daily statistics.
Yeah, you are correct that hospitalizations are one area that are going to be more focused on individuals who require an advanced level of care, and so that will be a little bit more stable over time regarding the number of infections that we have seen. Our hospitalizations, you know, I won't say are spiking in any way, but that we are seeing increasing hospitalizations as we see continued transmission of COVID-19 in the state. One of the other important things to remember is that with COVID-19, your symptoms typically develop very mild, and then after about 7 to 10 days, they do turn to be more severe among a subset of patients and then for various reasons, including the risk factors that we have mentioned before, underlying medical conditions, and so on. And so it's also important to have that perspective that you know, our number of hospitalized patients, number ever hospitalized, does have an impact within the COVID-19 response, and is a good indicator for you know, the level of activity, level of transmission within the community.
Gordon, this is Kim Olson-Rice, and I would also just add that right now there's 85 individuals that are hospitalized from COVID across the state. And that's out of approximately 2,400 hospital beds in our state. So it's still a very small percentage of the beds that we have.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, everyone. If you have additional questions, don't hesitate to email covidmedia@state.sd.us.